My name's Lynn Plessinger. I think I've met most of you already. This is the first annual, so it's definitely going to happen next year because loads of people come. First annual seminar series for Induction Week. I was very tired and I'm a very cheesy person, so I called it the New Year, New Idea Seminar. So Steve was a great person to kick it off because who do we want to think about when we're returning to intellectual work after a long summer of frivolity and joy, but a man who studies the nature of intellectual work. Steve's going to talk for about 35 minutes and then there'll be opportunity for questions and more general discussion. So keep a note of any questions that you've got. So take it away.
Okay, thank you, Lynn, for inviting me. Just generally speaking, I want to say Lynn has done a really good job in introducing all sorts of innovations to this induction process. What I want to talk to you about today, since I realize there's quite a mix of people in the room in terms of where you are academically, I want to talk about something that I think should be of interest to all of you, and this relates to what's generally known as the knowledge society. Okay, and this is a term that's used in sociology, and it has a lot to do with the very kind of specific role that knowledge has in what, broadly speaking, modern and postmodern societies. And if you want to put it in a nutshell, it's the idea that in some sense, knowledge is a kind of principle of social structure. Okay, this is in a way not a new idea, because if you think about the way in which societies are normally organized, right, when we talk about forms of authority, let's say, usually, or very often, forms of authority have been based on knowledge. And I suppose the way to think about this most naturally from a pre-modern standpoint is in terms of religious authority as a basis for some kind of social structuring, right? So you have a class of priests, for example, or even if you have secular authorities, in some sense, they have to be approved of by the religious authorities, okay? And this was very much true well into the 19th century, even in Europe. Okay, so that's a kind of very traditional notion, but when we talk about the knowledge society, we're actually talking about knowledge, you might say, in a kind of deeper and more pervasive sense. So it's no longer seen in such asymmetrical terms, right? Because when religious authority was kind of the primary means in which knowledge organized society, right, there were a few people who were said to have that knowledge, the priests and the theologians and all of those people, and everybody else basically just had to obey them or conform to them and so forth, right? So there was a real asymmetry between the knowers and those who didn't know. And this was also reflected in things like low rates of literacy and other kinds of indicators that we normally talk about with regard to the spread of knowledge in society. But when we talk about the knowledge society starting in the modern era, and you know, when exactly we want to begin this is an interesting question, but what we're generally talking about is a much more, you might say, democratized view of knowledge. Knowledge is in the hands of more people. So for example, you might say this begins with the spread of literacy. Okay, but also when we start to think about holding positions in society as requiring certain forms of competences, right? To hold a job means you need to know something first, okay? And so the idea of having to get credentials, right? The idea of having to pass examinations. So in other words, you don't just inherit the role of your father or mother, but rather you have to go through a procedure where you show you actually know how to do the job that is required of the position. That is also part of how the knowledge society gets its grip, right? So this idea of competence, that one needs to be competent in all kinds of roles. And you know, one aspect of this, which is a quite interesting aspect that sometimes people forget about, is even the idea of citizenship, right? So the point here is that there's a certain competence that's required to be considered a full-fledged member of a particular country. Okay, and so in order to vote, one needs to be literate. You know, there are all these kinds of things. This is all very much modern introduction. So there are So the idea that there's a need for certain kinds of competences, certain kinds of credentials, that you need to know something before you're allowed to do something, all of this is part of what the Knowledge Society is about. Now, in the 1960s and 70s, a very particular kind of notion of the knowledge society started to get promoted, and this is the one that we're normally thinking about, and it's very much tied with the introduction of new information and communication technologies, the computer revolution, basically. which in the period of the 60s and 70s during the Cold War was very much about mainframe computers, and the image was that there would be kind of a centralized administrative state that would rationally be able to pick up all the inputs of people, know what's going on with them, and then be able to process that and come up with some sort of just, equitable distribution of resources to enable the society to work properly. So, in fact, this idea is very much tied with the heyday of the welfare state and social democracy, this kind of image of the knowledge society. And one person who was very much promoting this idea and actually uses the term knowledge society is Daniel Bell, okay, American sociologist, social theorist, a person who was very much a public intellectual during this period. He wrote a very famous book in 1960 called The End of Ideology. And his view was, and this is very much a kind of knowledge society view, was that in the past, conflict in society was caused because basically people were making all kinds of grand claims about what works and what doesn't work in the world, you know, communism, capitalism, all this kind of stuff. But when we get into the knowledge society, we'll be able to resolve all this stuff in a fairly administrative, technocratic fashion, right? So Daniel Bell is a defender of the idea of technocracy. And this is very much part of what the welfare state has been about as well, right? That you administer to the needs of people, you collect the data from them, and then you process it and you figure out what's the right way to allocate resources. This is the original model, okay? Now, the interesting thing that happens, now on that kind of model, right, you can start to think about who are they going to be the important people in this society? Well, they're going to be the people who have the advanced technical skills. And back in the period that we're talking about, in the 1960s and 70s, right, you know, there were relatively few people who knew how to program computers, right, so there would be those kinds of people, and also there would be the sort of expert academic type of people, and if you look at the way in which Cold War governments were organized, very often you had, you know, professors, engineering, economics, these kinds of disciplines, right? The movement that was known at the time as cybernetics, which would kind of give you this kind of very comprehensive scientific understanding of society as if it were a machine, right? That was kind of the idea. Society is kind of a big machine, and we have to figure out how it works, and then we can push the levers in the various places to get things to work properly. Okay, and actually a lot of metaphors from this way of thinking remain with us today, especially in economics. So when we talk about stuff like, as we will hear next week with the first seminar that's being given, quantitative easing, right? This is some idea of thinking about the money in a hydraulic way, that you pump some out or you pull back in, right? It's a kind of very mechanistic way of looking how an economy works. Well, this is very much part of the kind of knowledge, original view of the knowledge society. Now, this kind of view had a lot of attraction in the sense that it actually provided a new basis for authority in society, namely the smart people, right? The people who had the advanced skills, right, in the vanguard disciplines. And this was something, by the way, that had a very much, and this is where Daniel Bell was right about talking about the end of ideology. This was a view that was common across the, capitalist communist divide. This was a common view on both sides, okay? And that this is why so much of the Cold War was in fact conducted as a kind of science race to get to the moon, right? A kind of arms race where you're constantly trying to come up with smarter and smarter weapons and then smarter and smarter ways of destroying them or anticipating them, right? This was all very much, Cold War kind of conducted this way. And it was all, and so, you know, relatively few people actually got killed, but there was a hell of a lot of money being spent on very advanced science and technology. And this was kind of seen as the way the future was going. So that was the original idea of the knowledge society. Now, as the Cold War ends, and a general kind of and a general kind of skepticism about whether all these kinds of ideals that are being put forward can actually live up to their own hype, right? So a kind of internal criticism as well. You start to get a different kind of notion of the knowledge society, which in a way almost turns this idea on its head. And here you have to think about a different sort of thinker who was actually promoting this idea. And this is one maybe some of you have run across, especially if you've read the Postmodern Condition, Jean-François Lyotard. Okay? Now, so in the late 1970s, in 1979, he was commissioned by the Higher Education Funding Council of Quebec in Canada to do this thing that became this report about the state of knowledge. What is the state of knowledge in the world? Where are we going? So this is 1979. In a sense, the worst was kind of over with regard to the likelihood of a confrontation between the US and the USSR, and the Cold War was beginning in a way people were thinking maybe it's going to wind down, right? There were already these kinds of peace negotiations. You're all too young to remember any of this, but it looked like that, you know, we weren't going to blow each other up by then, and that there was just a matter of time before relations in some sense would be normalized. Well, you start to get a different kind of picture coming out there, a more relaxed kind of picture of the knowledge society that's taking place. And part of what Lyotard sort of attacks, and this is very much kind of when we talk about postmodernism, because if you think about postmodernism, it's very much, you know, we associated with things like deconstruction and being very much critical of taken for granted forms of authority. But among those taken for granted forms of authority include academic knowledge, of course. And if you look at the way in which a lot of the sort of culture wars were being fought in the 1980s, kind of on the back of this, you know, where you start getting people questioning the composition of courses, let's say, in the humanities, right, which traditionally within the university is where the cultural identity of the nation is forged, right, and people are worried that there aren't enough women, there aren't enough people of racial diverse backgrounds, all of this kind of stuff, and that in some sense, the way the academic curriculum has been constituted is kind of a conspiracy against people, you know, and to reinforce a certain kind of authority structure. And so that needs to be deconstructed. And so so we start to get kind of the pendulum swing going in the opposite direction, where there's a sense in which the privileging of academic knowledge, which was going to be kind of new principle by which we organize society in the Daniel Bell technocratic kind of way, starts to begin to fall apart because even academia itself is shown to have within itself the same kinds of divisions, divisiveness, conflicts, discriminations that you see in the larger society. In this respect, the university is nothing more but a microcosm of the issues in society, and so how could it be trusted to actually resolve those issues? Right? And this is a kind of a live issue today, of course. Okay? And so one of the consequences of this was that you start on the back of this kind of movement, you start to get a much more sort of liberalized notion of where the knowledge is, you might say, in the knowledge society, right? So in other words, if, you know, the kind of knowledge that's relevant for society in the knowledge society isn't this kind of expert knowledge that only engineers and economists have, but rather it's kind of all over the place. And there's a kind of, as it were, the burden is placed on the academics to actually find out what that knowledge is and who's got that knowledge. And so, to a certain extent, this really does provide a kind of bonanza for certain parts of sociology, right, to in a way give voice to a lot of these previously suppressed forms of knowledge, right? And we're still very much living off of that capital today. And this was something that in the 1980s really started to go as part of the deconstruction of the original idea of the knowledge society. Now it's an interesting proposition, right? Because one of the things, you know, in this kind of analysis, which the way I've presented it so far, right, makes it look, you know, very anti-authoritarian, very much open to all of these suppressed, typically marginal voices that don't get very much heard in the academic literature, now are kind of coming out in the open in this knowledge society. But other things work as well into this, right? This is not the only thing that's kind of opened up by this kind of deconstructed notion of the knowledge society. And I think one of the ways that you see this is, I don't know how many of you actually follow something like the Times Higher Education, this magazine that comes out every week. I recommend, you know, those of you who are taking academia seriously as a career option or just want to know what the current state of affairs are in the world we're living in here, right, should have a look at this, because it tells you all about these kinds of changes in people's attitudes toward academia and how academia is adapting to it. And so one of the things that a few months ago was published as an article, which was very interesting, and I thought very telling about the kind of times in which we live, is that there's this rather famous, powerful accounting firm, Ernst & Young. I don't know, maybe you've heard of them, okay? They have done something very interesting, which in a way is very much in line with the kind of deconstruction of academic knowledge that I've just been talking about, but coming from a totally different ideological direction, but doing pretty much the same thing. Namely, they said they really didn't believe, they didn't believe that academic knowledge of the kind that you would learn even in something like a business course was necessarily giving you the kind of knowledge you needed to actually be able to work in their jobs. So that they were actually opening up their recruiting, because you know all these accounting firms typically give you examinations right before they go further to even consider you for the job. But for the first time, they weren't putting any kind of criteria that you had to meet before you took this exam. Because in the past, you usually had to have some kind of proper academic degree. You needed some undergraduate degree and they'd give you sort of a set of preferences of what sorts of fields would be most appropriate, and if you could demonstrate you did well in those degrees, then you'd be allowed to compete for one of their jobs. That was the usual, and that's the usual way these firms operate. But now for the first time, they've removed the academic requirement. So you can now actually apply for a job with these guys without having any academic background. And then the issue just turns out to be how you perform on their exam, which you may do well or you may do poorly, but for the academic qualification, doesn't matter. Now you see, that's a pretty radical move. That's one important accounting firm doing it. But what is it telling you here, right? You know, in a way, this is one very key way in which the sort of significance that academic knowledge had in the knowledge society back in the days of Daniel Bell is disappearing. Okay? Right? And it's disappearing in a very interesting way, you might say, from the standpoint of political economy. Because in the past, the way in which academic knowledge functioned so importantly was because it operated as a kind of credentialing mechanism. And by credentialing, right, it means that you know, you go to a university, and the university basically tells any prospective employer that you're employable. So in a sense, the employer can trust the university to make sure that you are actually good for them. Right? So it served as the university in this respect served as a kind of middleman. Okay? Now that's how it looks like from the standpoint of the employer. But from the standpoint of you trying to get a job, right, the university is a kind of obstacle you have to overcome. Right? And the thing is, once you overcome it, then you're open to all these jobs that are available. But what if we can remove the obstacle? Now you see, in political economy, and those of you who know something about Karl Marx will recognize what I'm talking about, right, there is this thing, rentiership. The rentier class. Now from Marx, in Marx's analysis of capital, these are the most awful people in the world. And so, for the sake of this argument, we are those people. Right? And these are the people who basically earn living by owning land and charging rent on people who live there, but don't do anything productive with the land themselves. They just sit on it, and they force everybody else to have to pay rent to them. They don't invest in it, they don't do anything with it, they just charge rent on it. And because their land is centrally located and really important, people have to pay them to do whatever they want. To put up a factory, to put up a house, and the way they make money is purely through rent, and it's typically hereditary. Okay? Now this is what academics look like. Academics are these knowledge rentiers. Okay? From the standpoint of this kind of deconstructed knowledge society that we're moving into. Right? Because from the standpoint of the employer, now think of yourself as Ernst & Young for a moment, right? An academic degree is just some kind of thing people go through, and if it doesn't really provide a really credible signal of whether the person you're going to hire is going to be any good at the job, why bother with it? Why not just go somewhere else? Why not just avoid what is turning out to be a kind of bottleneck in the labor market, namely the university? Okay? Now, Ernst & Young is not alone in thinking this way, that basically academic knowledge is a kind of more of an obstacle than a facilitator. Because we are so used to thinking about academic knowledge, especially in the first notion of the knowledge society I was talking about, as a way of getting a leg up in the world, right? You get this degree and you're able to open yourself up to jobs that nobody else can have because you need to have the degree to get the job. But we are now living in a world where the value of academic knowledge has become so deconstructed that even a lot of employers who would by no means identify themselves with the radical left, in fact, they would identify themselves more with a kind of libertarian right, are beginning to think, well, this academic knowledge, what function does it have? Right? And this is especially true, right, if you actually look at the way in which academic curricula are constructed. What do we teach students? What drives the curricula that we provide students? Well, quite obviously, you know, you're in sociology, the history of our field drives it, right? The sociology curriculum, the curriculum of any academic discipline, including physics and all the rest of them, because this is not just a problem sociology and economics has, this is a problem that also physics and biology have, right? All disciplines, the curricula, are driven by the internal history of those fields. And those fields have, as you know, very idiosyncratic histories, right? They've developed in a certain way, right? They've operated in a certain way, and that's why when anyone who's not a sociologist talks to you, they think you're talking jargon, right? Because that, is the, in a sense, that's the mark of the insularity of the field, right? There's a very specialized way in which you learn the stuff, you recode the stuff, and then you spit out the stuff. And the question is, for someone who is not part of this game of sociology or economics or any other academic discipline, what good is it? Right? What good is it? And this, it seems to me, in the world in which we're living now, is going to be an increasingly important question, especially from the standpoint of trying to figure out what is the what is the basis for public funding of universities. Okay? Because in the past, it was very persuasive to say that it was important to have lots of universities so people could skill themselves up. Right, and then they can get better jobs and then be more productive and bring greater prosperity to the society. In fact, I was checking the other day, the phrase knowledge economy, right, was first introduced in this country by Peter Mandelson when he was business secretary, you know, about 20 years ago. Okay? And that was the vision. That was the vision. He's kind of the tail end of the Daniel Bell thing. Somebody like Peter Mandelson. And that was that view is still vaguely kept alive in government. But we're beginning to see a very serious challenging of that kind of idea and a repositioning of academic knowledge, not so much as providing value added to your skills and your knowledge and all the other things you already come with, but rather as a kind of rentiership, namely as a way of monopolizing, of bottlenecking knowledge and making it in fact more difficult to actually interact with other people in the society. So to give you, how much time do I have?
You have 10 more minutes.
Okay. Well, an interesting kind of initiative that's taken place in the United States to just sort of dramatize this. Some of you may know the great Silicon Valley billionaire, Peter Thiel. Okay, Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel has this thing called the Thiel Fellowship Program. And the Thiel, by the way, who is the guy who first bankrolled Facebook, he gave the initial capital to it so it could take off. He's the co-founder of PayPal, right? This guy knows, he's a venture capitalist, basically. But he's a guy he's very smart about it. He's also got a JD from Stanford University, and he was a philosophy undergraduate major, so he's also very well educated as well. But one of the things that he has come to believe over the years is that universities, that there are more efficient ways of getting things done. So what he does is, he offers every year in a very high profile kind of exercise in the United States to about 15 or 20 people the opportunity to forego acceptance into a top flight university and to just immediately go into the entrepreneurship business. So in other words, these are people who would have gotten accepted into Stanford or MIT or Caltech or one of these kind of places, right? But instead of having to go through the four-year curriculum in those places, right, they would immediately be given the opportunity to explore the kinds of ideas that in a sense got them accepted because of their intelligence into the university, but now make them realized in the marketplace. And he would cover the cost, right? So, you know, from the standpoint of the person taking the Thiel Fellowship, they don't lose anything, because even if they fail, they could always apply again, I suppose, and they do well in the exams, they could go back into the university. Okay? And he's made it very clear that what he thinks that the academic system in general is an enormous protected bubble. Okay? And that, in a sense, he's trying to puncture it. And he's trying to liberate knowledge from the academia. From the academics. Okay? Now, I have to say, that now this idea actually, this kind of mentality, you might say, though not necessarily this scheme, but this mentality I would say is very much common among Silicon Valley people and among the sort of, you know, information technology entrepreneur sets, even the ones who in fact have gone through the universities. I mean, one of the interesting features about a lot of these entrepreneurs, I mean, I think of Bill Gates immediately, is that they're dropouts, right? So in other words, they get accepted into Harvard, but then they can't quite hack it, and then they drop out and they become billionaires, okay? And so, of course, if you have that kind of experience, and if that kind of experience is out there, you're likely to be, you know, kind of wondering, well, is university really necessary? What is the point? And what is the point of having so many of them? And what is the point of having everybody go to them? Right? Because obviously, you know, you might want people to do rather specialized subjects, you know, because they're intrinsically valuable and so forth. No one is denying that, but do you need to have them in the quantity that we have universities in? This is the point, right? Do we need to have so many of them, especially publicly funded? You see, this is kind of the way the argument's being turned now, okay? Now, there's an interesting historical precedent for this, and again, you know, those of you who, you know, I don't presume people know all that much history here, but it's always interesting to realize this is not the first time this issue's come up. During the Industrial Revolution, so the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th, early 19th century, okay, it was a very, very clearly a frontal assault on the university system, okay? And in fact, they were very much fueled by this movement, as you have all heard of, called the Enlightenment, right? You know about the Enlightenment. The interesting thing about the Enlightenment is even though we now associate the Enlightenment with something that universities have to do, the Enlightenment as a movement in the 18th century was originally an anti-university movement. It was, you know, and if you look at the French philosophers and so forth, and even if you look at some of the English guys like David Hume, these people were all outside the university system, okay? And they thought that the universities, because at that time the universities were controlled by the church was the authority structure for knowledge back then, right, they were holding back knowledge, right, because they were not accrediting or credentialing the kinds of knowledge that was in fact becoming relevant to the modern society that was emerging. And this is, of course, the industrial knowledge, the knowledge from technology, the steam engine, right, the spinning wheel, all these kinds of things, right, all of, you know, the things that made especially the industrial north of this country such a big deal in the early 19th century, right, the people who were doing that were not university trained people. This is not saying they were unschooled or illiterate. No, that's not true. They were. They were schooled and literate, and they certainly interacted with university people, but they were not part of the academic culture. They took what they needed, and they ran with it. Okay? And so it was a really an interesting kind of battle that took place in the 19th century, and this is where the modern university comes into being, right, in the 19th century, for the university to regain that lost sense of authority. So there's our interesting battles that you could read about that take place in the middle to the late 19th century about the extent to which Oxford and Cambridge, for example, should house laboratories on their campuses. Because laboratories were seen as too factory-like for the kind of nice green, you know, sort of campus-like, humanistic thing, right? And so that was a big battle. But the argument was one, you know, saying, look, if we do not take on board the science and technology that's emerging, if we do not make that part of what we are just going to be left behind. Okay? Now, I think we're having in terms of where universities are today, I think there's a similar kind of battle taking place, no longer having to do with the kind of heavy, you know, industrial technology of the 19th century, but rather with the information and communication technologies that are emerging now, and the extent to which universities truly embrace them, not just as things that they use, but it's things that in some sense are constitutive of the kind of knowledge that they produce. Okay? You know, so for example, One of the arguments that actually worked well in the 19th century to bring the Industrial Revolution into the university was to say, well, look, you know, a guy like James Watt, who invents the steam engine, it's a great device, it works well, but, you know, the way it works and the way it gets improved is very much done through trial and error, because this guy's not a physicist, right? He does things just on the basis of experience and all these other artisan guys sharing their experience, right? They, you know, open source, as we might say now. That was kind of how those Industrial Revolution guys operated. Especially, this was long before patent law really became a big deal. So it was a kind of open source sort of movement where people were sharing knowledge and learning through trial and error. So the university comes in and says, if you really want to improve these technologies, you need to understand the first principles. So you really can't do the study of steam engines. You can't really do this kind of technology that's so radical and radicalizing our society unless you know physics, and unless you know higher mathematics, and unless you know deep concepts, and unless you've read Isaac Newton and James Maxwell and all those guys. And so then you have to get credentialed in that to show that you're actually competent to be involved. And so that's where the cycle comes in, and where you start to get the buildup of the places that become the main centers for the training of science and technology in the early 20th century, whether we're talking about MIT, right, or Caltech in Pasadena, California, or Imperial College here. It all began that way. And so we're kind of in a situation like that now, where in a sense, you know, we have this highly deconstructed knowledge society, which has been so deconstructed that even the academic knowledge itself is now being called into question in terms of its value to society, okay? And it's quite generally acknowledged that the new radical knowledge that's being produced is very often happening outside of the academic quarters. And so then the question becomes, how does the university positively respond to this development? Right? How does it recapture the advantage that it had in the past? You see, insofar as one wants to see the university succeed in the 21st century. Because in the early 19th century, the university had to be seriously reinvented in order to survive. You studied history, the 19th century was a period of reinvention, right? And that's when the universities lost its religious associations and all the rest of it and became these kinds of places to train the next generation of secular elites. We need something similar now if the university is actually going to survive the kind of knowledge society that we're currently living in, which to a large extent we as academics do contribute to by our rather self-deconstructive attitudes toward established forms of knowledge, right? We, in a sense, it's not just those guys in Silicon Valley who are doing this, we're doing it too, okay? And so that's where I want to, leave the issue and open it up to some discussion, okay? Thank you.
Questions, comments, clarifications.
Thank you for your inspiring speech. I want to ask about how would you distinguish common sense knowledge or information knowledge and sociological knowledge? And related with that, I mean, why do we really need universities for sociology?
It's a bit late to ask that question. Well, first of all, I mean, it's an interesting point, right? Because within philosophy, okay, there's a whole strand of philosophical thinking that actually thinks that sociology is nothing more than self-conscious common sense, okay? And if you follow the work, people who follow in the tradition of Ludwig Wittgenstein, for example, okay, I mean, there's a great deal of skepticism on the philosophical side about whether sociology is actually doing anything different other than just recoding stuff in hard words, okay? So there is an open question there. I do think the thing that always made sociology different, and again, this is not so obvious maybe nowadays, but I do think the impulse to have a sociology as a discipline was to get a systematic understanding. Right, because common sense, right, is the kind of knowledge you have to make your way around the world as an individual. Right, you pick it up through your family, your friends, your neighborhood, and common sense tends to be quite provincial, you might say. Right, in other words, it works in the places you normally live in, but it's not obviously going to work in the places you don't live in. right? So it has a kind of provincial quality to it. Now, sociology as a science, right, originated because people were basically thinking about the nation state, at least, right? In other words, they were thinking, you know, if you look at somebody like Durkheim, I think that's very clear, that when he says society, he means something like a nation state. Where the premise is that you have large, different groups of people who live, you know, locally quite differently, but are somehow integrated together to make up some kind of whole, right? And this whole is society. And there's no reason to think that any particular individual living in that society would necessarily have that kind of comprehensive understanding. So you need, and this is where then you start to justify theoretical categories in sociology, right? Because, you know, sociologist talks about the economy, right? How do you experience it in common sense? You go to a store and you buy something, right? But the economy is not just you buying something, it's how that connects up with everybody else buying something and a whole lot of other things like banks, right? And that's the economy. And you see, this is, I think, would be the argument for historically for sociology, that it provides a kind of second-order systematic knowledge that you're just not going to get from common sense. But that presupposes, you see, an idea like the nation-state, that in some sense we are all connected together in this kind of integrated fashion. And as you know, we live in a world where even though people do believe they are connected together, they don't necessarily believe they're connected together in the manner of a state, right? They feel greater affiliation, let's say, with people in other parts of the world who share common interests, blah, 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 more than they do with, let's say, people who live in a common geographical area, you know, like a country with well-defined boundaries, which is, again, what Durkheim, I would say, was thinking about. So that's kind of how I would, you know, how I would put the issue. So the day the nation state becomes no longer a relevant entity, I think it's going to be very hard, actually, to justify a distinct science of sociology. In that sense, Durkheim is, I think, very much an anchor point. You know, even if you disagree with the particular views he offered, the ontology, you might say, right? Because Durkheim is the one who, after all, puts the idea of social facts as a distinct, separate ontological entity on the table. And I think that needs to be taken quite seriously as kind of the bottom line, you might say, for sociology. I'm sorry, I went on at length, but... Yes.
I want to ask about the Ernst & Young and the Till Fellowship issue. Do you think to some degree that's a PR stunt on both the side of Till and Ernst & Young? And in fact, most of the Till Fellows, I think it's about 10% actually go and start companies and the rest go back to university.
No, it's true. No. It's true. It's a mixed bag. But to my mind, I think the fact that they would do this, right? So, they're not doing this frivolously. And what I think is PR about it is it's sending a kind of signal of intent, right? So in other words, even if the Thiel Fellowship program, let's say, doesn't work as intended, that there are not enough guys and gals who come up with new innovations, right? Nevertheless, he's going to try something else. He's not going to stop, right? Because he's made it very clear that what he wants to do is he wants to break the university's monopoly. And I think with people like Ernst Young, okay, look, from an economist standpoint, the primary value of a university, looked at from an economic standpoint, is as a way of clearing the labor market. In other words, the university makes decisions for potential employers to save the employer time in doing so. So if you've got a first from Oxford, you're employable. Don't have to even do anything anymore. We don't even need to talk to you. We just need to just give you a job. Right? It's a signal, market signaling model. And what Ernst & Young is saying is that the university does not work as a good market signal. Because the way people are trained, even if they get the first class degrees, doesn't necessarily make them compatible for the job. And so in which case then, why bother putting that requirement? Whereas we could just examine them directly for the stuff we really want them to do. Right? So the university no longer serves a market signal function. That's, I think, what Ernst Young is getting at. So even if they end up not being able to get all the people they want this way, okay, nevertheless, I think what they'll probably do is improve their examination procedure rather than going back to the university. You see what I'm saying? Yeah.
It sounds as if Ernst & Young, that they're taking over the role of the university in a way, that they see themselves as trainers of kind of workforce, and that they're going to be the ones to examine and
train
the population
into
their own.
Yes. But look, even here's the thing that's kind of, and again, you got to put yourself in their position. These accounting firms, just like the law firms do, right, actually do train the people they hire already. Okay? So they get these people with these fancy degrees, and then they've got to actually spend 6 months training them. And some of them turn out to be complete losers. And then they're back to square one, having invested all this time. You see? So I think you take for granted on their side that they will have to train people. They're already training people, including the guys who get the first from Oxford. Okay, and so the question is, why do you need to figure out whether they've got a first from Oxford? What's the value added from the standpoint of what they're concerned about? I mean, it's a bold move in the sense that, you know, obviously all these prestige and halo effects issues about coming from Oxford and being able to say, my company has 95% of its employees who are Oxford graduates, blah, 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 right? You know, there's a kind of halo effect thing. I could see why that would be attractive in principle. But if it actually does not facilitate you identifying the right people for the job, why have them? It's a luxury you can't afford. Okay? And this is especially true if you imagine a lot of these people, you know, who go to these very fancy universities and get these very specialized degrees will be pretty much excellent, but in those things that they were trained in, which may be only tangentially related to this other specialized job that they're now trying to go for.
Yeah. Do you think that's where the real, is the onus on where value is placed being moved? So instead of putting value on having X amount of informed students, the value is moving towards individuals who are free thinkers who might be disruptive?
Well, I don't know if a generalization can be made about it. I think what we are seeing, which I find a little disturbing, is a kind of, it's a provincialization of knowledge that's going on, right? In other words, in the past, there was this view, and this was kind of like the amateur view of how you run the world, right? And Parliament still has this, actually. Whatever people want to say about MPs and the way Parliament is run, Parliament in this country is basically a society of amateurs, right? Where you have a bunch of people, all of whom were trained in the classics, doing all kinds of crazy jobs in government, right? And it's just because they're very clever, smart people that they actually manage to fake their way through most of this stuff. Okay? Well, that kind of view of how you run society, right, is one that in a sense respects kind of general values of knowledge. Right? So the kind of thing you're talking about, that, you know, if you're a clever guy, regardless of what subject you studied, right, if you did really well at it, then you're likely to be critical and sharp and, you know, you're able to reason properly. It doesn't matter what the content of the subject is, it's just that you did very well and you showed intellectual skill. But now we're moving to a time where, in fact, the content is very important and academic content isn't the content you need to get the job done. So it's a provincialization of knowledge. I don't think it's necessary. I mean, I don't know if Ernst and Young want people to be any more disruptive than anyone else does. But they want people who can do accounting jobs well. Right?
Isabel has a question.
Like you said before, doesn't matter where you get your degree. I can think it's very, nobody can go to Oxford, so maybe it could be more democratic. But however, just how can do knowledge in a capitalist way? Because everything that's important is get the job, doing well in Ernest Young, and that's all.
So, that's right. That's right. That's provincialization. That's the provincialization of knowledge. Yes.
So in which way you can do it, knowledge in that time? Because I'm just wondering about Japanese government, they delayed or closed some humanities faculties.
Yes, that's right.
Because that's not needed for the capitalism, for the economy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
I agree. Okay. This is the thing. This is where, at the end, you know, I was talking about the need for the university to defend itself in the face of all these changes. The way the university defends itself is not by trying to become more like what Ernst and Young want. Okay? That's not the way to do it. The university actually has to reassert what the value is of having the academic knowledge. But I do think that part of that is going to mean that the value of the academic knowledge isn't necessarily in the content as we understand it in a discipline-based way, but it's more about the quality of mind. So, you know, Luke was talking about being disruptive and all this kind of stuff. Well, actually, academics are very disruptive. In fact, that's the only thing academics ever seem to do well, is disrupt, right? Academics are very bad on positive, but they're great on negative. And you see, there's a certain kind of quality of mind that goes along with that, that has a kind of, you know, critical, suspicious, probing, right, analytical kind of thing, which a university education really does train you very well in, regardless of the content of the subject area you're in. And that's something that universities are good at, and they give you prolonged exposure to that way of thinking. And that's something that's very precious and needs to be defended, because that is not what the employers want, but it is something that is very valuable if you're going to have a dynamic, progressive society. Okay? So that needs to be defended, okay? And universities got to be very clear that that's what they defend, rather than trying to shift their curricula to make it more like what Ernst & Young want, which is, I'm afraid, what happens very often when you start to see things like these closures of the humanities faculties in Japan. Yeah?
And what do you think academics are contributing, you were saying,
to this state of things? Useless. Academics are useless. Not well, okay. I think this could open up a whole different discussion. I think that there's a real problem with academics identifying with the university as an institution. Okay? Academics are fine defending their little turf. Right? So they'll, you know, I mean, academics tend to be very provincial, you might say, with regard to their own horizons. They're like labor unions in a way. So they don't really kind of think about the kind of larger institutional issue. What makes a university distinct from a training center for a large corporation or accounting firm? Right? They don't really get into that kind of discussion. Right? They're more concerned with very immediate kind of workplace issues. And I think this is where you actually need some very constructive kind of, you know, sort of from the top thinking about what the university in the 21st century is supposed to be, other than just, you know, training people better for the jobs that are going to be available, okay? And I don't see actually a lot of academics participating in that discussion. Or when they do try to get into this discussion, because some do, they just go on a nostalgia trip. They just start talking about the 19th century, right? And you know, the Stefan Collinis and, you know, those of you who follow a lot of these discussions about the compromising of the university, right, most of these people are usually, you know, waxing eloquent about something happening in the 19th century as being where, you know, the universities ought to be going back to. But what you need is you need a kind of progressive future, 21st century one, that is able to stand up to the challenges that we're facing now. But I think I think one of the ways you see this is, right, academics, well, most academics don't even like to be in the university, frankly, right? The most prized piece of university property is a car park, right? Get in, get out, and that's it, right? I mean, and I think as long as you do have this kind of mentality, right, it's not surprising that things have drifted this way. You know, I mean, what my view is, I mean, there are two kind of levers that could be used. First, you would, if you had visionary university administrators, because in a sense, the guys running universities ought to be the ones really on top of this issue I'm talking about, because they're the ones who are the flagship leaders. And in the United States, you actually do have a lot of people who do think about these issues I'm talking about. But in this part of the world, it's not so, it's, you know, or in Europe in general, there isn't that kind of academic leadership from the top. There's much more a capitulationist behavior where you just roll over with everything. Okay? That's one point. And I do think that if you don't have that kind of leadership in place, it's not going to happen. Academia will just continue to drift. But I do think there is a potential cost, and this is something I mentioned briefly in the talk, and we do need to think about this. We need to think seriously that as the kind of idea of the knowledge society expanded over the last 25, 30 years, and it became this place where everybody trained in order to get jobs, universities have expanded massively. There are more universities than ever before, more people going to them, more academics employed in them. And part of the consequence of what I'm saying is that we may need a contraction. Okay? And we may need to redeploy things that we now treat as universities into maybe vocational schools where they may be good at that kind of thing, and that we should actually be very clear, but maybe relatively restrictive, about the sorts of things that we want to protect as academic institutions. Okay? Because there was a kind of Faustian bargain that got made with the Knowledge Society came into being. Because government gave all kinds of money to universities to expand, and the universities promised they were going to train everybody, and they were going to contribute to this prosperity. So the universities bought into this story, and that's why they're as big as they are now. But maybe what we need to do is to contract. And that's the hard part, to make that argument fly.
I think they're coming. I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop because I can see the next class coming in. At Warwick at Standard, everything finishes at 10:02. So it is your first experience.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.